My sermon this morning is on sex. Now, aren't you glad you came to church? Aren't you glad you didn't stay home to watch football on TV, or go to the beach, or go out to brunch someplace? The Song of Solomon is a book about romance. To prepare this sermon, I consulted a renowned expert on romance, Miss Piggy's Guide to Life. Now, for those of you who are too young to know who Miss Piggy is, here's a picture of her. She answers questions about romance in her book. First question, Miss Piggy, what do you do if a man you like and who likes you still wants to see other women? Her answer, although this is by definition a somewhat emotional matter, you should approach it in a calm, reasonable, and mature way. What I would do is calmly, reasonably, and maturely explain to him that if he values his life, he should change his behavior. Second question, Miss Piggy, is there a cure for a broken heart? Her answer, only time can heal your broken heart, just as only time can heal his broken arms and legs. Now, romance can be dangerous. There is no safe investment in love, C.S. Lewis wrote. In The Four Loves, he said, to love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will possibly be broken. The primary purpose of the Song of Songs is to celebrate love and marriage between a man and a woman as God intended it to be. That's the approach I will be taking this morning. Now this, the literal or natural interpretation, is no less spiritual than the popular allegorical approach, which pictures the book either as symbolizing Yahweh's love for Israel or Christ's love for the church. In this sermon series, we have been combining elements of both approaches. Peter Kreft describes the book as a double love story, vertical and horizontal, divine and human. The Song of Songs teaches that sexual love should be treasured, not perverted. Sex is a sacred gift from God to be received and enjoyed within the bounds of marriage. The book also teaches that God is the great lover of our souls. Everyone longs to give themselves completely to someone, to have a deep soul relationship with another person, to be loved thoroughly and exclusively. But only God can meet that need on the deepest level of our being. Everything God originally made was good. And it's good in its place, but bad when it's out of its place. Fire, for example, can cook a meal and warm your house, or it can burn your house down and kill your family. Likewise, water can quench your thirst and is essential for life, but it can drown you or destroy your home with a flood. So it is with God's sacred gift of sex. It's a wonderful blessing in its proper place. Unfortunately, the modern world, like the ancient world before it, has become obsessed with sex and made it into an idol. Now, before continuing, I'd like to say a few things. First of all, if some of you are uncomfortable with the subject of today's sermon or feel that it is inappropriate to talk about sex in church, let me remind you that Solomon wrote this book under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Therefore, according to 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17, we should all profit by a proper understanding of these chapters, regardless of our gender or marital status. Now, after the second service, I went out into the patio to get some coffee, And normally people would come up to me and greet me and say, thank you for that wonderful message, whether they understood it or not. Some people will just, that's what they say. I had quite a few men who saw me coming and they averted their eyes and navigated around me. I'm not sure what that meant. So obviously, whatever it is that I said made at least some people, particularly men, uncomfortable. The Bible speaks very frankly and reverently about these matters. And for those of you who cherish the allegorical approach, I'm not trying to deprive you of the blessing of seeing Christ and the church in this book. But I want us also to experience the blessing of reading the book on its own terms as beautiful, evocative poetry. Honestly, this week as I prepared this message, I found my love for my wife growing deeper, but also I felt freed up in my relationship with God as well. Finally, for those of you who have suffered the loss of love or have been disappointed by love or have been damaged by love, I believe God also has a special blessing for you this morning. Now, all this being said, let's open to the Song of Solomon, chapter 5. And I'll be using the English Standard Version, which is the same as the Bible in your pews. The first scene is the wedding night, chapter 5, verse 1. Now, there is a discernible narrative flow in this section of the Song of Songs. Verse 1 of chapter 5 is a continuation of chapter 4, 16. In the last line of verse 16, the bride has invited her lover to come into his garden and enjoy its fruits. Now, this is poetry, of course, and we don't need to decode what the poetry means. Between chapter 4 and chapter 5, however, off camera, out of sight of the reader, they consummate their marriage. Now, notice in the text, the ESV version, you'll find he, others, she, indicating who is speaking here. Let me say those are not a part of the original text. Those are the translators doing the best they can to pick up who's speaking here. So those are just aids to our understanding, not divine revelation. So he says, verse 1, I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh and my spice, and I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. And then there's another voice here, possibly several voices, but I think it's one voice. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. Now, there are numerous interpretations as to who is speaking here. These words seem to be expressed to friends, namely the bride and the groom. And I wonder, is this God speaking here? Is this God chiming in? And if so, God is blessing their union. Sexual pleasure in marriage is based on God's approval. Now the scene changes in verse 2, and scene 2 is the bride is searching for her beloved. She says, verse 2, I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound, I like the King James Version here, hark. My beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I had put off my garment. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh. My fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. Now the bride has retired for the evening. For the second time in the Song of Songs, she falls asleep and is having a dream. The theme of both dreams is the fear of lost love. Now in ancient times, special bridal chambers were prepared for the wives of the kings. And she hears someone knocking at the door. Was she asleep and awakened by the knock on the door, or is she still dreaming? It's a little hard to say, but the verbs slept and awake are participial forms, suggesting that she is still asleep. In other words, she is dreaming. And this is what she's dreaming. The Message translation says, I was sound asleep, but in my dreams I was wide awake. Oh, listen, it's the sound of my lover knocking, calling. Now she recognizes her husband's voice outside the door. And she can tell that he's in an amorous mood. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew and my locks with the drops of the night. Now clearly he is asking her to open the door so that he can come into her bedroom and make love to her. But it's late at night. Perhaps he's been working late and it's cold and damp outside. We imagine him shivering out there on the doorstep. She's all warm and snug in bed, but she's tired. It's too much trouble to get out of bed and put on a robe and walk over to the door and let him in. Not tonight. I have a headache. I'm not in the mood. Undeterred, he tries to open the door latch, but the door is locked from the inside. She hears him fumbling at the door, and suddenly her mood changes. She longs for intimacy with her husband. So she jumps out of bed and opens the door too late. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. I called him, but he gave no answer. Again, the Message translation makes this more explicit. But my lover wouldn't take no for an answer. And the longer he knocked, the more excited I became. I got up to open the door to my lover, sweetly ready to receive him. Desiring and expectant as I turned the door handle. But when I opened the door, he was gone. My loved one had tired of waiting and left, and I died inside. Oh, I felt so bad. I ran out looking for him, but he was nowhere to be found. I called in the darkness, but no answer. Now the joy of the wedding night has given way to apprehension, guilt, and disappointment. We are such flawed and fragile creatures. Our hopes are mixed with fears. We are so easily wounded, so easily disappointed. Often our fears surface in our dreams, arising from some sense of failure or fear of inadequacy or fear of rejection. Adjustments are necessary in the seasons of married life. Sometimes passion is quenched by illness, fatigue, or stress. And then there are the differences between men and women. Our uncertainty about what the other is thinking. The various ways we misread each other's signals. The variations in our life rhythms. Our unwillingness to change our preferred patterns. Our own self-consciousness. All contribute to breakdowns in communication. Now, Dan Fogelberg wrote a song in 1983 called Make Love Stay. He was married three times before his death of cancer in 2007. Fogelberg described the song as a musical question that unfortunately eludes me still. Now that we love, now that the lonely nights are over, how do we make love stay? Now that we know the fire can burn bright or merely smolder, how do we keep it from dying away? But mysteries, his word for romance, but mystery is a thing not easily captured, and once deceased, not easily exhumed. Now that we love, look at the moonless night and tell me, how do we make love stay? Now Solomon has been knocking on his lover's door, but she has not responded. The fire has been burning bright, perhaps now it's beginning to smolder. So he gives up and goes away. And then she realizes that she has been insensitive to him, and she fears that she has wounded his spirit, and now she is sick with longing for him. Now, there are many ways that couples are insensitive to each other and many reasons why they separate. A prompt action should be taken to restore trust and intimacy. The fire must be tended daily. The key is to not let love die in the first place. Now keep in mind that this is all in a dream, not on a page from her diary. Also, don't forget that this is poetry, not prose. American poet Robert Frost said, "There are many other things I have found myself saying about poetry, but the chiefest of these is that it is metaphor, saying one thing and meaning another." Now, if we were to decode the book, we would say they made love together. But Solomon's way of saying that is that they enjoyed each other in the garden. And we ought not to decode the poetry because it loses some of its power by doing that. But we do need to understand something of what's transpiring in their relationship in order to gain benefit from it. And so we go to verse 7. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me. They bruised me. They took away my veil, those watchmen on the walls. Boy, when Solomon finds out what they did to his queen, boy, are they in trouble. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him, I am sick with love, I am head over heels in love with him. And so we have this voice from these others, or the friends, they're called the daughters of Jerusalem. And always in our marital difficulties, we understand that although marriage is very personal, it is not entirely private. Our marriages go on in the context of a wider community of people. And so she recruits help from the daughters of Jerusalem to help her reconnect with her husband. And so they ask, what is your beloved more than another beloved? What makes him so great? O most beautiful among women, what is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us? Now the bride's remorse has driven her out into the city at night to seek her lover, but everything then begins to go wrong. The watchmen beat her and shame her. Probably they mistook her to be a prostitute. Why else would a woman be wandering around the city in the middle of the night? But perhaps this is simply a poetic way of saying she must overcome overwhelming obstacles in order to mend the breach with her husband. Now, one commentator suggests that this abuse is her subconscious beating her up. She is, after all, dreaming, and it's beating her up for her failure to respond to her husband's needs. Whatever the case, she is undeterred by this ill treatment. She stays on course. The theme of seek and find, which characterizes this poem, expresses her desire to be reconciled with her husband. Now, there is a realism in the song that we should appreciate. The course of true love seldom runs smoothly for long. There are always a few bumps in the road. For every moment of ecstasy, there seems to be moments of hurt, pain, and misunderstanding. The openness that lovers experience with each other makes possible both extremes, and so true love will always be tested. Not even love can guarantee a perfect performance in personal relationships. Not even Christian love. Time and humility help. We are born broken, said Eugene O'Neill. We live by mending. The grace of God is the glue. The simple fact is that whenever we marry, whoever we marry, we are marrying someone who is damaged goods, just like ourselves. And so we need God's glue, His grace, to keep us together. Building a happy marriage is learned, practiced, tested, and strengthened with the help of God's endless love and grace. So she calls for her friends, the daughters of Jerusalem, to help her find her lover. If you find him, she says, let him know how much I love him. Now, during courtship, we always look for signals from the other person to help us gauge how the relationship is going and where it's going. And sometimes we have difficulty reading those signals. Now, Marie and I have been happily married for 35 years, but we had a long and torturous courtship. At a certain point in our courtship, Marie called it off. She called it quits. I seem to remember at the time that it was a six-month trial separation, but the way she remembers it was that her intention was that we're done, we're finished. And that was those few months after we had separated were very, very painful and difficult. I would wander around the streets of Costa Mesa at night, dodging the police helicopters overhead with their spotlights, just crying out to God. And I have to say, this may sound a little sick, but I would actually go hide behind the oleander bushes behind her apartment, hoping to just get a glimpse of her shadow. That was pretty sick. And I thank you for that you didn't slap a restraining order on me. Probably get arrested for that kind of thing nowadays. And after a period of time and kind of God's timing, we reconnected and kind of resumed our courtship. And from time to time, she would write me a letter. And I would always do exegesis on the letters to see, to try to glean, how is she really feeling about me? And one time, she signed the letter, Te quiero mucho. And I was all excited about this. I always was excited whenever she'd speak Spanish to me, except when she was angry. And then I didn't really want to know what it meant. But I remember asking one of my students at Harvard Bible University a certain phrase that Marie had said to me one day when she was really angry, and the student went, So I don't want to know, but I asked a friend, what does te quiero mean? Does this mean that she loves me? And they said, well, mucho means whatever she's feeling. She has a lot of it. Te is promising. That's the familiar to form. Quiero. And I said, well, does that mean, is she saying I love you? And they said, well, not quite. I didn't know whether this is a green light, proceed with caution, or a yellow light, slow down and prepare to stop. No less a need once married, Marie and I have been saying, I love you every day for 35 years, except for a brief period many years ago when we separated. And most of you probably don't know this story. But one day I came home and there was a note from Marie saying that she just needed some space. She had moved out. And I was devastated and heartbroken and stricken. I didn't know what to do, how to manage this. And Lori Perez, who was here in the first service, had made her guest house available to her in South Laguna. And we were having some serious family problems with being on the same page and raising our kids. And Marie just needed some space away from the tension and the problem. And so I found myself going down to South Laguna like Solomon knocking on her door. Can you open the door and let me in? And she always opened the door and let me in. And we continued to say, I love you, te amo mucho. during that season of separation. And I think we learned a lot, we gained a lot in that period of time. But it was tough. We have to learn how to read each other's signals and how to interpret them properly and act in an appropriate way. So for 35 years, I've been saying, I love you. And I love her more each year that passes. Now the daughters of Jerusalem want to know, how is your beloved better than others? Maybe Lori Perez was asking Marie at the time, well, is he really worth all this trouble? I don't think she was saying that, but she would have had every right to wonder that. She, in fact, was very helpful in that she was condemning of neither one of us, but wanted to be as helpful and supportive as she could to find a constructive solution to the problems we were having. In other words, she's asking, what are the qualities that attracted you to him in the first place? What makes him so special? A modern way of asking this question might be, what's so great about him? Is he really worth all this trouble? Surely you could find someone who would treat you better than he does. And so in verses 10 through 16, she extols the virtues of her husband. She explains, well, here's why he's special to me, and focuses on his physical attributes. Everything about him is attractive to her. And the reference to gold and jewels and precious stones expresses the high esteem she has for her husband. And so here we are, scene three, the bride praises her beloved. My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000s. And here's the part I like, verse 11. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. Now, Jeff could read this without cracking up, but when Marie and I were reading this together this week, whenever we got to her praising him for his thick, black, wavy hair, I just couldn't get past that without laughing. And so Marie has assured me that she loves my thick, black, wavy hair. So Victor and Anna are two of my students from Harvard's Bible University. Could you put me in your will, and I want your hair, okay? So, and she goes on in great details using poetic imagery that doesn't mean much to us today. The point is that she's lavish in her praise of her husband. Now, I want to call special attention to the last thing she says in verse 16. This, she says to the daughters of Jerusalem, is my lover, and this is my friend. The Song of Songs is unabashedly erotic, yet it is never satisfied to be content with the physical alone. A normal person finds the erotic ultimately meaningful only if there is trust and commitment and mutual respect. The writer of the song understands this. Our hero is her lover, but he is more, he is her best friend. Old Testament scholar Daniel J. Estes comments, it is significant that this descriptive song ends on the note of friendship, not sexual attraction. Song of Songs teaches repeatedly that sexual intimacy is the physical expression of love, and that love is built upon character and friendship. And so next, we find the bride's friends offering to help her find her husband now that they know what he looks like and now that they know what she appreciates about him. And so in chapter 6, verse 1, where is your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you? And so we come to scene 4, intimacy restored. We find them together in the garden of love. Verse 2, she says, my beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to graze in the gardens, and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He grazes among the lilies. Now, the bride's friends are offering help to to help her to reconnect with her husband, but that's what friends do. They don't make the problem worse, or they shouldn't. They make it better. They help you find a solution, to seek reconciliation. But she's not really asking them to form a search party to find her truant husband. She doesn't need their help that way. She knows where to look for him. She knows where he is. He's tending his garden. Now, we ought not to take this literally. According to chapter 4, verse 12, verse 16, and 5:1, she is his garden. The garden is also a symbol of sexual intimacy. Here the two images merge. Remember, she's only dreaming. But I think she awakens at this point to the realization that he's never really left her. Her insensitivity to him has strained their relationship, but Solomon's love and commitment to her have not been lost. He has been there for her all the time. And so the anxiety was without foundation in reality. She is her lover's, but he is also hers. She finds him browsing in his garden of spices among the lilies. Verse 2. Now, the erotic implications of this language seem clear. Her fears were unwarranted. As he possesses her, she possesses him. Now, at this point, we should blush and pull the curtain and give them a moment of privacy. All that is embedded in the beautiful, evocative poetry. It is not explicitly stated, it is said indirectly. Now, she has praised her husband for his many virtues. Now he returns the favor. In this next section, Solomon reaffirms his love for his wife by extolling her beauty and her character. And as we see, he is lavish in his praise for her. The poetic imagery may seem strange to us, but it makes sense if we understand it in the context of the relationship they have with each other. So we see scene 5, Solomon and his bride delighting in each other. And he says, "You are beautiful as Tisra, my love, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners. Turn away your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead." Men, try that on your husband sometime. Your hair is like goat hair, and you're going running down the mountainside, and your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from the washing. All of them bear twins. What's that all about? I don't know. Again, it's poetry. This is how people in love talk. You have to kind of come up with your own love language. And get this, your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. You'll never be able to eat a pomegranate again without thinking about this verse. And boy, look at this. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one. The only one of her mother, pure to her who bore her. In other words, there are all these other women. Marie said, don't even think about it when we were reading through this together. You know, the young women saw her and called her blessed, the queens and the concubines also, and they praised her. Who is this who looks down like the dawn? And here we have beautiful poetry that we can connect with. Beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners. Well, she is awesome. Now, the word Tisra means desirable. Tisra was a city in Samaria, so we might paraphrase this, you are as beautiful as Paris in springtime. Or think about the most beautiful city you've ever been to. Now that's how he feels about his wife. You are like the dawn in its glory. Fair as the moon, bright as the sun, formidable as an army with banners, a symbol. She's not just lovely, she's strong. Now the reference to queens, concubines, and young women may well be a reference to the royal harem, but not necessarily to his harem. Again, we're reading poetry. This is a poetic device used to say you are without equal among women. This is his way of saying that she is one of a kind, totally outclassing all other women. She outshines them all. Every wife needs to hear that from her husband. He reassures her that all is forgiven. And by praising her, he communicates his love for her. He has not changed. Despite the rift in their relationship, he still loves her more than ever. Now he takes care in this section to not communicate the false impression that he merely wants her sexually. Estes says in his book, in Song of Solomon, sex is not the right way to kindle or rekindle true love. As this extended scene shows, it is reconciliation that rekindles love. And only then can love overflow into sexual intimacy. That means sometimes we have to say, I'm sorry, would you forgive me? I was insensitive to you, I hurt you. I'm so sorry, would you forgive me? That is the power of forgiveness. Now finally, we come to a very strange section of the poem, verses 11, 13. She seems to be speaking here. I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley, to see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranates were in bloom. Before I was aware, my desire set me among the chariots of my kinsmen, a prince. And then others chime in here. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you. And then he says, why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies? Now, the Hebrew poetry in these verses is difficult to decipher. The various English versions don't even agree how these verses should be translated. And many scholars consider these to be the most difficult verses in the book. And the suggestions are more, almost as numerous as the commentators. Now, perhaps she is looking for some kind of reassurance from her lover. We constantly look for that. Even if we've been married for many years, we need constant reassurance from each other. Has Solomon's love for her budded and bloomed, or has it faded? He lets her know that she is his beloved wife, riding in his chariot next to him, honored before all the people of his realm. He loves her, he's proud of her, and he loves her with all of his heart, and he wants everyone to know it. Now, as for verse 13, I've checked several commentators. I still don't have a clue what this verse means. Dancing before two armies? What in the world does that mean? My hunch is that she wants to know if Solomon still finds her desirable, but that's my best guess. You know, I think we should allow for some mystery in our study of Scripture, especially when dealing with poetry. Not everything we read in Scripture is easily explained. Poetry is in some kind of a code, and we want desperately to decode it. But sometimes it's not supposed to be decoded. It is to be felt through, not thought through. As a fraternity brother of mine used to say, don't try to understand it, just dig it. Now, he was usually stoned when he said that. But it's true all the same. Don't try to overthink this. Don't try to figure it out. Don't try to analyze it into the dust. I don't think it's necessary to make everything that God has made implicit, explicit. We should allow room for mystery in our relationship with Christ, but also in marriage. Now, on a practical level, we can draw a few principles from this poem. Number one, beware of creeping separateness in marriage. Don't let temporary lapses in intimacy go on too long. The bride wastes no time seeking reconciliation with her husband. Simple neglect can damage the soul of a marriage in a very short time. And many marriages die from neglect. The same is true, of course, of our relationship with God. The Christian life is not a life of uninterrupted intimacy with God. We know of divine absences as well as his divine presence. We know something of fear and insecurity even in our Christian faith. But the truth about God is that He is absolutely committed to us, and His love for us never wavers, even when our love for Him does. And secondly, beware of allowing bitterness or unforgiveness to take root in your relationship. Ephesians 4, 26 and 27 says, "In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold." Many marriages have let too many suns set on too much anger until the love in the marriage is hopelessly, irretrievably gone. Number three, good marriages are ones in which each partner has learned the other's language of love. Both husband and wife need to communicate constantly affirmation to each other. Marriage, number four, is personal, but it's not entirely private. Sometimes we need to recognize the value of the community that supports us. We need help from friends and family or trusted counselors to help us navigate stormy times in our marriages. We are so grateful, Marie and I, that Pastor Brad was, without condemning us or judging us, was a support to us during that time of separation. We're so grateful to Lori Perez and being a part of the solution and not contributing to the problem. And fifthly, sexual enjoyment between a married man and a woman is God's gift to be received with gratitude and to be expressed for the mutual benefit of both husband and wife. Now, one major reason why sexual immorality should be avoided is that it exchanges true intimacy with a counterfeit. In 1983, the Welsh singer Bonnie Tyler recorded a song called "Total Eclipse of the Heart." Most of you would be familiar with this song. It became one of the best-selling singles of all time. "Once upon a time, I was falling in love. Now I'm only falling apart. There's nothing I can do. It's a total eclipse of the heart. Once upon a time, there was light in my life. Now there's only love in the dark. Nothing I can say. A total eclipse of the heart." Now, many people today are willing to settle for love in the dark for no love at all. The price the singer in the song pays is that while once she has a memory of falling in love, now she's only falling apart. Many people despair that love in the light is even possible. It seems like such an elusive dream. Love in the light is blessed by God. Love in the dark is not, no matter how we might try to justify it. Now that's why Paul instructs young Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:22, "Now flee from youthful lusts and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart." Sexual sin is dangerous and it is dumb because it enslaves us, leads us to dead-end relationships, and leaves lasting scars. Now, it's possible that for some of you, chapters like these, Song of Solomon 5 and 6, open some painful wounds, and we don't want to pick at scabs today. But if you have suffered the loss of love by death, betrayal, or personal failure, or some other reason, there's hope for you. Even if you have messed up big time, there is grace and hope for you. Now, I've asked my good friends Lauren and Virginia Hatlin to share their story and close our service with a few words of encouragement and blessing.
Hello. If you've known Lauren and me for more than 5 minutes, you know that our marriage was put together miraculously by God. We married in 1987, nearly 26 years ago. We first met 3 years prior to that, when Lauren and his first wife, Carol, came to pray for me. Just a few months later, as Carol was terminally ill and I was going through a divorce, the Holy Spirit spoke to me that Lauren would marry me. Fast forward 3 years, when Lauren and I finally got together. He lived in San Diego, and I lived in Roseville, which is a suburb of Sacramento. So we had a long-distance courtship, but thankfully a very short courtship. Lauren would come to Roseville, or I would travel down to San Diego about twice a month. Now, on the weekends we didn't see each other, Lauren would send roses. And the verse on the card with the flowers was always a verse from Song of Solomon. That's when I discovered that Lauren was a romantic. But the greatest romantic is God. God created marriage. Concerning the first man, Adam, God said, "It is not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him." Now, as I suffered through the pain of divorce in 1984, 1985, 1986, the way I coped was to go deeper with God. And as I leaned on him, he cared for me. He spoke to me through his word. I particularly loved Isaiah chapter 54. In fact, I camped there. The whole chapter ministered to me. But there's one verse in particular there which says, "For your maker is your husband." God really was my husband through that time. He helped me. He took care of me and my children in a myriad of ways. God will always be there for us. He's there for us in whatever state we may be in, whether we're single, married, divorced, widowed. But if we call upon him, he's there. He loves us. He wants the very best for us.
You've heard Virginia's half of the story. The Lord worked with me in a different way. The death of my first wife, Carol, in December 1984 was devastating to me. In my loss, I pressed into God and let him heal me and strengthen me. I was blessed to be part of a prayer group who supported me and prayed healing for me. In spring of 1985, the Lord revealed that he had a wife for me, but I didn't know who she was, where she was, or how we would get together. Over a period of 2.5 years, as I prayed with friends in the prayer group, one or more of us would get a picture or a vision of the woman I was going to marry. We call them wife visions. These wife visions didn't have enough detail to let me identify who the person was until one week in August of 1987, when everything came together and pointed to Virginia. I had seen Virginia once in 1984, and she'd visited my prayer group once in 1986. So at this point, I wrote her a letter detailing how the things the Lord had shown me about the woman I was to marry and how she fulfilled every detail. When she received the letter, she called me immediately and told me how God had revealed to her in 1984 that I was to be her husband. The following weekend, I flew up to Sacramento, where she and her daughter Kirsten were living. That was the third time I had seen Virginia. As we prayed together that evening, we were led to set our wedding date for December 27th, about 4 months later. This coming December will be our 26th anniversary. I am one of those who knows the pain of losing a spouse through death. And I am one who knows the kindness of God in healing a broken heart. Virginia and I would like to pray over this congregation and minister to you out of what God has done for us. So I'll start. Okay. Just receive. Lord, I thank you for your great mercy and your great love for all of us. Lord, I would specifically like to minister to those who have lost love through divorce, lost love through death. Lord, I ask that you would reach out now and that you would touch hearts. I pray you would heal the brokenhearted and bind up their wounds, Lord. Bind up their wounds. As you pour your love into their hearts by the precious Holy Spirit, minister to the broken, Lord. I thank you for your great love. Just touch them, Lord. Touch hearts. And where grief and sorrow have stayed around too long, in Jesus' name, be gone. Move on. Lord, I ask you would bring hope. I ask you bring joy. I ask you bring love. Continue to heal the brokenhearted, Lord, and continue to bind up their wounds. And to those who have caused broken hearts and caused pain, I speak to you also in that there's forgiveness in Jesus Christ. It's level at the foot of the cross. All of us have to come to that. There's forgiveness. The blood of Jesus will cover that.
While Lauren was praying, I saw, as I looked out, I saw in the spirit many broken hearts here in this congregation. And what I saw, you heard our testimony, both of us, how we leaned in to the Lord. And I saw a golden knit of these hearts. Now, when a bone is broken, when it's healed, the area that heals is stronger, actually, than the other bone around it once it's been completely healed. And that's what I see in these hearts. It's like, do not be grieved. The joy of the Lord is our strength. The joy of the Lord is your strength. And so now, Lord, I really do pray for everyone here that where there has been robbing and loss, you say, Lord, that you will restore what the locust has stolen. And sometimes he doesn't restore us all in the same way. He won't necessarily give to all of us a new marriage. Hopefully, if you're in a marriage that's struggling, he will renew that marriage and renew your love. But perhaps you're single and that's the way God is going to leave you, where God is, your maker is your husband. He will restore. I ask that he will heal the brokenhearted, bind up our wounds, that he will restore all that the locust has stolen. And as we look to him, that we will always remember that he wants the very best for us. He knows the plans he has for us. They are plans for good and not for calamity. not for evil, to give us a future and a hope.